It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headlines.
Dozens of Nigerian schoolgirls abducted in Borno State. South Sudanese rebels claim to have captured the capital of Unity State. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. On the same day, a devastating car bombing in Abuja killed more than 70. Unidentified gunmen kidnapped at least 100 girls from a school in northeast Nigeria. Witnesses said the mass abduction occurred after assailants attacked the town of Jabok in Borno State late Monday. There's been no claim of responsibility. Borno is one of three states where the government has declared a state of emergency. Meanwhile, officials are looking at ways to help victims of Monday's bus terminal bombing in Abuja that killed more than 70 and wounded dozens more. Heather Murdoch reports.
Benny Lahr, the chair of the Committee on Human Rights in the National Assembly, says many victims of the bombing were working-class people, barely scraping by in Abuja's satellite towns, where civil servants and other employees of Nigeria's pristine capital live because they can't afford to stay in the city. The towns are notorious for lacking electricity, clean water, and for bad roads. Lahr says the government should find a way to help the blast victims recover economically.
Those that have lost their breadwinners or their families, they would definitely need some relief and some economic reintegration to the families of the victims.
The Director General of Abuja's FCT Emergency Management Agency, Abbas Idris, says the government is working to coordinate hospital response to mitigate the suffering of any future attacks. Idris also says the local government is increasing security ahead of the World Economic Forum for Africa next month. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, but analysts blame Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group that has killed thousands of people, saying it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Rebel fighters in South Sudan claimed Tuesday to have retaken control of Bientou, capital of oil-producing Unity State. A spokesman for former vice president and opposition leader Riek Machar told VOA the opposition is trying to shut down all oil production because it doesn't want the government to use revenues to buy weapons. Army spokesman Philip Aguirre confirmed fighting in Bientou, but didn't say the town had been recaptured by rebels.
There is still fighting on in Bientou, and we are waiting for the report from our field command. There is still fighting over Bientou.
Meanwhile, the United Nations says up to 1,000 refugees from South Sudan flee to Ethiopia every day, with nearly all of them women and children in very poor condition. An estimated 95,000 have fled to Ethiopia since the conflict erupted in mid-December, after the government accused Mr. Machar of leading an attempted coup. Gunmen have kidnapped the Jordanian ambassador in the Libyan capital Tripoli. Foreign ministry officials say assailants in two cars opened fire on the convoy carrying Ambassador Fawaz al-Attan Tuesday morning as it traveled through the city's center near the Jordanian embassy. Libya's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed al-Aswad said authorities are closely following the case and working to ensure the safety of the ambassador. The motive behind the abduction is unclear. However, Reuters news agency quotes a Libyan investigator as saying the assailants demanded the release of a Libyan jailed in Jordan. The official Sudanese news agency Suna reports that President Omar al-Bashir has decreed a ban on political parties from holding meetings without government permission. Earlier this month, members of the Reform Now party say security agents prevented them from holding a discussion forum, detained the leader of the party's student wing. The decree follows Mr. Bashir's pledge to hold a national dialogue to address urgent demands for a change in his quarter-century-old government. Togolese State Television says nearly 50 died when a bus and truck collided north of the capital Lomé Tuesday. Reports say among the dead, citizens from Burkina Faso and Nigeria, 15 others were severely injured. The president of Djibouti, Ismail Omar Gila, will visit the White House May 5th. Djibouti, located on the Horn of Africa, has played a key role in the U.S. strategic presence in Africa, hosting Camp Le Menir that houses conventional and special forces as well as aerial drones. Britain's Overseas Development Institute says Africans lose nearly $2 billion a year in high fees on funds sent from abroad by relatives. The report that it issued suggests that reducing the charges would generate funds for better education and clean water. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of the stories you've heard can be found in our internet website. That address, voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Instability puts Africa's economic prosperity at risk.
We look at stable countries which suddenly erupt, either because of a bad election, because of corruption, and you found that each one of our countries is at risk. And by extension, Africa's own prosperity at the moment is at risk.
Donald Kaberuka is president of the African Development Bank. One of the defendants in South Sudan's treason trial disputes government's claims of an attempted coup d'etat. Sudan's Minister of Information says political parties need permission to hold events outside their headquarters. And Ivory Coast, the prime minister, says achieving justice in his country will take time.
We cannot ask a country like Cote d'Ivoire, with the number of judges we have, to make these kind of things well quickly. Tomorrow we'll say that it's not justice, it's banana justice.
Daniel Kablan Duncan is Prime Minister of Ivory Coast. Zambia's ruling party says it will not condone political violence. And Mount Everest climbers identify a mechanism involved in the development of adult-onset diabetes. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The head of the African Development Bank, Donald Kaberuka, says achieving economic progress does not depend just on having impressive numbers of GDP growth, high-rise buildings, or first-class highways. He says development institutions like the African Development Bank, looking to promote growth, must also consider political factors. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
When recent fighting erupted in South Sudan, the African Development Bank had just approved a $25 million electricity project. Neither bank president Donald Kaberuka nor his staff saw the conflict coming.
Someone back to my staff is it, what is it that we not understand?
Kaberuka says when conflicts erupt in countries, the bank's financing of development projects has to start all over again.
We did finance development in Somalia. We built roads. We built hospitals, but the country went back into shambles. I had an office in Bangui. We had just opened an office in Juba. But when you go back to square one, I'll be going further than my traditional mandate of economics and development, looking closely at the political economy of the country.
In a recent report of the so-called fragile states of Africa, Kaberuka said bank managers have not taken political risks into account when making development decisions.
We concluded that fragility is a big risk for Africa. We looked at stable countries, hitherto stable countries, which suddenly erupt, either because of a bad election, because of corruption, and we found that each one of our countries is at risk. And by extension, Africa's own prosperity at the moment is at risk.
That sustainable development cannot be achieved without security was one of the key themes of the EU-Africa summit that took place recently in Brussels. Since 2004, the EU has provided more than $1.6 billion to support peacekeeping missions like AMISOM in Somalia and MISCA in the Central African Republic. EU institutions have also pledged over $38 billion for development assistance for Africa in the next 7 years. Andris Piebalgs, the EU Commissioner for Development, says 70% of those funds will go to less developed nations based on specific criteria, including a measure of per capita income.
So that means if country has, is more richer, it gets less. I would just give example, Gabon. The second is vulnerability. It means the country is more landlocked or some structural weaknesses that also gets more.
The commissioner also says that some countries are doing better.
I would take Ethiopia or Rwanda, where basically our support managed to bring countries to new level of development. It's still very poor countries, but you see that they are moving. Are there risks? Yes, they are. But I think in this politics, no one is safe.
In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Ivory Coast Prime Minister says his country is on track to reach double-digit economic growth this year and become an emerging market by 2020. Daniel Kablan Duncan says the government has worked hard to restore security and investor confidence following the 2010 post-election violence that killed 3,000 people. VOA's Margaret Bashir spoke with the Prime Minister and has this report from New York.
Prime Minister Duncan said Ivory Coast has a favorable business climate and is a gateway to Western Africa. He said the country has an ambitious development plan that aims to generate enough growth to double national revenue and make it an emerging market in the next 6 years.
Cote d'Ivoire is changing quickly. You can see by the highways, the roads, even the agriculture sector is changing.
Ivory Coast, or Côte d'Ivoire as it is known in French, is best known as the world's largest producer of cocoa beans. But it is also a major producer of coffee beans, cashew nuts, palm oil, and rubber. And it is working to expand its mining, oil, and gas sectors. On Monday, Mr. Duncan addressed potential financiers at a conference in New York City on investing in Ivory Coast. Afterwards, he held hours of one-on-one meetings with representatives of a wide array of international companies interested in working in the West African nation. The Prime Minister said he knows that if the country is to have strong, sustained economic growth, it needs peace and security on the ground, which includes national reconciliation and accountability for crimes committed in the post-election period. In November 2010, Ivory Coast had contested presidential elections that led to months of violence. At least 3,000 people were killed during the crisis as armed forces loyal to former President Laurent Gbagbo and newly elected President Alassane Ouattara committed what human rights groups say were war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity. Today, Mr. Gbagbo is in custody at The Hague awaiting trial at the International Criminal Court. His wife Simone is in Ivory Coast, and authorities say they will try her in the national courts. Last month, the Ouattara government handed over to the ICC Charles Blaise Goudé, another Gbagbo ally who is charged with committing crimes against humanity during the post-election violence. Critics of the Ouattara government have accused it of only holding its rivals accountable, but not its loyalists. Mr. Duncan dismissed that, saying justice in a country like his takes time.
We cannot ask a country like Côte d'Ivoire, with the number of judges we have, to make these kind of things well quickly. Tomorrow we'll say that it's not justice, it's banana justice. So let the justice do his work, fair justice on both sides.
He said the country is rebuilding the court system and training judges to deal with charges such as crimes against humanity, something with which they have no prior experience. Despite challenges, Mr. Duncan said Ivory Coast is on its way to becoming an African showcase on the political, economic, social, and cultural levels. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, New York.
The trial of four political detainees accused of attempting to overthrow South Sudan President Salva Kiir resumed Tuesday in Juba, with former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot Atem taking the stand. Dagot told the court he does not believe there was any coup attempt, as alleged by the prosecution. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
At the start of the day's proceedings, prosecution lawyer David Charles asked the five-judge panel if it would be all right if the prosecution reviewed the court's records to ensure that all witness statements are being recorded. He also requested that the court allow prosecution to re-cross-examine former SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum, who had already testified in court last week. Lead defense lawyer Monyiluak Alor objected to the prosecution's requests, saying they were using it as a delaying tactic.
The request to go over the records was made in an earlier session, and the court said, okay, in the spare time you can go over the records. But then the way they were presenting it here, they wanted to stop the session and they take time to go over the records. Of course, that one we objected to it. The second part, we also objected to it because Pagan gave his statement and the court said they have no questions to him.
Prosecution lawyers asked the court to guide the suspects when they testify to ensure they limit their statements to only the charges leveled against them. Following a half-hour consultation, the judges rejected all of the prosecution's requests, noting this is the only chance the suspects will get to fully explain themselves during the trial. Former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot Atem then testified, accusing unnamed government officials of a witch hunt and accusing some officials of deciding to go after the four even before the fighting broke out. Dagot pleaded not guilty to all the charges leveled against him, including subverting a constitutional government, insurgency, and publishing false information. Alor says he is quite satisfied with today's testimony.
Because they emphasize their point and they also concentrate on the weaknesses of the evidence that were produced by the prosecution.
The hearing was adjourned until Thursday when former envoy to the U.S., Ezekiel Lol Gatkwoth, will testify. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
It is Wednesday morning, April 16th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Sudan's Minister of Information has reiterated that political parties in the country are free to hold meetings and gatherings without interference from the government. But Ahmed Bilal says parties wanting to hold rallies or other events outside their headquarters must get permission from the government. Critics say this contradicts President Omar al-Bashir's April 6 assurances to political parties that they are free to hold activities in and outside their offices. Information Minister Bilal tells me President Bashir is determined to create a conducive environment ahead of a national dialogue, which the president has called for.
Actually, on the contrary, I held yesterday a conference with all the press, and I declare that there is actually a decree from the president. This decree says any party can hold on any sort of an activity inside their headquarters without any permission. The only restriction is that after 12 p.m., there is no loudspeakers allowed until the morning. And after that, they can do what they like the whole day. But if they want to hold on, for example, a demonstration or to make any sort of an activity outside in a courtyard, in an open air, they have to take a permission before. Yesterday, one of the opposition parties, headed by Dr. Ghazi, they hold actually a big demonstration outside in an open air without interference from the authorities. We are all making this conducive environment for the dialogue or the debate which is going on in Sudan. Not only that, but even in our public radio and television, we are making an equal opportunities for the opposition and for the government parties as well to declare and to say what their opinion.
The fear, Mr. Minister, is that some people were suggesting already that President Bashir was going back on his word, his promise on April 6th, that political parties are free. You are saying he is not going back on his word.
Actually, this is the practice now for this freedom. We have no restrictions. If you read the newspapers today, the whole of them, they are talking about this opportunity and about the freedom and about raising all the security reservations and these things.
What do you make of this allegation by the Reform Now party? It said that one day after the president said that parties were free to hold their discussion, that security agents prevented it from holding a discussion forum. Is that true?
The Reform Now party, now if you read our newspaper, they said they have tested the government and they passed because they made an outside activity outside the headquarters and nobody actually prevented them. What they did, they took a permission for that. Yesterday it was that.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's Minister of Information. He spoke with me from the capital, Khartoum. Zambia's Information Minister says President Michael Sata's administration will not tolerate acts of violence perpetrated by political groups to create chaos and destabilize the country. Joseph Katema's comments came after Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the opposition United Party for National Development, or UNDP, was attacked while participating in a program on a private local radio station in the country's northern Copper Belt region. His supporters accused members of the ruling Patriotic Front Party for the attack. But Information Minister Katema tells reporter Peter Clotty the ruling party will disown any member involved in the attack after an ongoing investigation is concluded.
The Patriotic Front government believes in the rule of law and at no time is it going to tolerate any acts of violence against anybody, any of its citizens. And it doesn't matter from which political party the perpetrators are coming from. And I believe, I heard from the spokesperson of the Patriotic Front as well, did mention that anybody who will be found in perpetrating any acts of violence will be disowned when the law starts to take its course.
What do you say to opposition groups who say that it is cadres or staunch supporters of the ruling party or the Patriotic Front that often launch these attacks verbally as well as physically on opposition groups or opponents of President Michael Sata or the ruling party?
It cannot be very correct. I would want to take this opportunity to address both parties, the ruling party and the opposition political parties, to call for level-headedness when we are handling matters of importance to this nation, that we should moderate our tones. Provocations as well should not be tolerated. It be from the ruling party or from the opposition parties. It takes two to tango. So I am appealing to both parties to moderate in the way that they are conducting business, partisan business.
Some groups have said that it appears that the political space in Zambia has been narrowed following the assumption of office or the election of the Patriotic Front into government, and that it makes it uncomfortable for them to participate fully in the democratic tenets in Zambia.
In fact, the political parties, opposition political parties, are enjoying a very conducive environment. Little did we hear of any opposition party being given platform on a national television broadcaster, national public media, which are owned by the government, solely owned by government. They can participate and are given equal platform, which has never happened in the history of this country. But then government has always appealed to the opposition parties and any political player that in as much as freedom is given, it should go hand in hand with responsibility. Going to the media to go and propagate violence is not also acceptable, as it has been done by the political leadership of the UPND.
Joseph Katema is Zambia's information minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka, using the world's highest mountain, Mount Everest, as an outdoor laboratory. A group of British researchers has identified a mechanism involved in the development of adult-onset diabetes. Experts say the findings could lead to development of treatments to prevent the disease. Viewer's Jessica Berman reports.
At more than 8,800 meters above sea level, Mount Everest in Nepal is the world's highest mountain. Climbers require supplemental oxygen because the air is so thin. Hypoxia, or lack of oxygen, is a risk factor for the onset of type 2 diabetes. So researchers with the Mount Everest project sought to identify the mechanisms by which low oxygen levels contribute to disease in patients who are critically ill with diabetes. Mike Brokut, a professor of anesthesia and critical care medicine at Southampton University, led the study, which began at an Everest base camp 5,300 meters above sea level. The expedition included about 200 climbers, but Brokut says researchers focused on 24 individuals who underwent assessments of glucose control, body weight changes, and inflammation biomarkers. The measurements were taken 6 weeks and again at 2 months. Eight climbers then continued their trek to the peak. In the low oxygen environment, Grocott says the participants' insulin levels began to rise, indicating their bodies were becoming insulin resistant. There also was an increase in biomarkers of inflammation and oxidative stress, or cellular damage, similar to what's seen in people with type 2 diabetes. On the ground, Grocott says the findings suggest treatments might be developed to prevent the disease.
Helping to control the tendency towards diabetes may be interventions that are focusing on either the development of oxidative stress or this inflammation.
In an article published in the journal PLOS ONE, investigators report the abnormal biomarkers caused by the extreme altitude were reversed once the participants came off the mountain. Many people who develop diabetes suffer from sleep apnea, in which their airways become obstructed, sometimes hundreds of times per night.
That is likely to predispose them to certainly intermittent hypoxia during sleep. And that may be something that is contributing towards this tendency to develop type 2 diabetes.
Grocott says investigators are now comparing the climbers, most of whom were Caucasian, to the Sherpa to see whether genetic differences protect the indigenous Nepalese population from diabetes. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. A Confederation of African Football inspection team is in the Ivory Coast to assess the country's potential to host the Orange Africa Cup of Nations. The five-member panel has just completed a tour of Guinea. After the Ivory Coast, they will also visit Algeria, Cameroon, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Zambia, who are also bidding to stage the 2019 and 2021 Nations Cup. In Kenya, Somalia's under-20 international Sadiq Abdulgader Mahmoud has been released from police custody in the Kenyan capital Nairobi following the intervention of the Somalia Football Federation. Mahmoud was arrested in Islii, a predominantly Somali-inhabited neighborhood in Nairobi, during a security operation following a spate of bomb attacks. Mahmoud plays for Kenyan Premier League side AFC Leopards. On a happier note, Kenya's under-20 side play their Italian peers in Nairobi today, Wednesday, to mark a new era of cooperation between Kenya and Italy in the development of local football. The Kenya Football Federation head Sam Nyamweya told the Nairobi media on Tuesday. The match is also a build-up for the Kenyans who face Tanzania in the return leg of their Africa Youth Championship qualifier next week. The Kenyans drew 0-0 with the visiting Tanzanians 2 weeks ago. In Olympic news, the Africa Junior and Youth Weightlifting Championships enters its second day in the Tunisian capital Tunis today, Wednesday. Weightlifters from 15 countries are competing at an event which is also the qualifier for the Youth Olympic Games in Nanjing, China in August. Meanwhile, Rwanda will represent Africa in the Boys and Girls Beach Volleyball Contest at the World Youth Olympics in Nanjing, China in August. Rwanda edged hosts Egypt by 2-1 in the boys' final in Cairo, while the Rwandese pipped Namibia in a similar fashion in the girls' finals. Finally, in golf, hosts South Africa begin their title defense at the Africa Zone 6 Golf Championships in Cape Town today, Wednesday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Wednesday morning, April 16th.
Call it Boko Haram or whoever may be hiding under the umbrella of the Boko Haram destroying innocent lives and property in Nigeria. I want to assure you today that 99 days are for a thief, but just one day. One day shall be for the owner of the house. A day you shall say, had I known, I wouldn't have destroyed the innocent ones and their property. Prince John Usher, Cossiva North, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Unidentified gunmen have kidnapped at least 100 girls from a school in northeastern Nigeria. Witnesses say the mass abduction took place after assailants attacked the town of Chibok in Borno State late on Monday. That's it for this Wednesday, April 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Tracy Carter, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day, Africa.
African music mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African music mix on the Voice of America. bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. From 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on The Voice of America.
From Washington, this is VOA.